probably recess again.
I'm in education, but I'll come here because this is my prayer. But there will be meeting.
Mr. Helen, if you would continue.
Page one, R112, section 111 on the House side, a federal oversight provision that subdivision doesn't apply to genetically engineered organisms for which an environmental impact statement is required under previous House provisions. And then page R113, this is the environmental health tracking and biomonitoring bills. This is a different House bill that's in the Human Services Finance Committee. Is that where it is now? And there's some differences. The House defines advisory panel, defines community, defines designated chemicals, defines environmental hazard. The Senate uses a very similar definition but calls it hazardous chemical over on 48.1. Senate also has a definition of exposed group for the purposes of that bill. The next page is basically identical. Page R115, the House has a subdivision 2 biomonitoring, how the commissioner conducts biomonitoring of communities and so forth, and biomonitoring of pregnant women and minors on a voluntary basis. Health data, subdivision 3, it'd be public data. That's part of the bill. There's some more provisions in this later on in the side-by-side, but that's the initial part of those biomonitoring bills.
And, Madam Chair, as Mr. Helen explained, the House language is from the Human Services Bill, and the Senate language is in the bill that was sent to this conference committee. They both use the same funding source. The question is which bill, and it's a PCA funding source, of which bill this will ultimately come out of. And I don't know if that's a decision. I'm not sure if anybody's made that decision or how that decision is going to be made as to whether it's done here or done over there.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's likely it will be done here, but can't say that for sure. But I think, isn't there some funding in the House health bill, there's some separate funding that is not from the remediation, from the PCA, correct?
That's correct. It's the House has $300,000 in each year from the same fund. I think you're using remediation fund. But the House also has $700,000 each year from health. So it's a $2 million. It's a $1 million, $1 million.
Total, yeah. And I think, Madam Chair, one of the reasons you might see the additional language on the House side is it may cost a little more to do it that way, as opposed, I think the Senate was fully funding what it passed in this bill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Knopf, can you just briefly tell us what the Senate bill doesn't do, or maybe Mr. Helen can tell us that, what the difference, just in a very summary fashion, if that's possible?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I can't tell you in any detail because this bill was never in committees that I work with.
Madam Chair, we can just get that information later.
Okay.
I think
we can do a comparison of the two in a separate sheet or something.
I think that would be very helpful for the outcomes. Particularly, I think there's some additional chemicals that will be tracked in the House bill, and that's the major difference here. Some urban chemicals.
So page R114 is county timber sales. It allows a county board to sell any timber, including biomass, as appraised or scaled timber.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Saxhog has that in his bill, Senate File 438, which is out of the Tax Committee, I think, on the floor now. We do have a similar provision, actually an identical provision in that bill.
And then we're back to the biomonitoring and health tracking bill on R-119, and in the House version on 478-20, we've got a sentence that says, the commissioner must consult with key stakeholders in the review of commercial ether, and that the commissioner must also review the findings from similar state and federal agencies. And in the Senate side, they have a subdivision two where there's a participation in an interstate clearinghouse that allows the PCA to participate, and including a list of all the products containing the ether and information on all exemptions granted by the state. They also have a subdivision three that the Commissioner of Administration has to give priority and preference to the purchase of equipment, supplies, and other products that do not contain that ether.
Madam Chair, maybe I should explain a little bit on this one, too. It's a little different history on the Senate. The Senate Policy Committee actually, the state procurement provision, it was modified comparable to the House side in the original bill. But you'll see here that on 478.27 on the House side, it says unless exempted under that section. You don't see that section here. That's being created in the House bill, in the Human Services bill. It's not, we couldn't bring everything in because it's only the stuff that lines up with what's in the Senate file. So the Senate file only does the report and the procurement provision. When we only did the procurement provision, the language was taken from the original bill rather than as modified by the Policy Committee, because the Policy Committee language didn't work on its own. You'll see one and two are kind of a, it looks like that there is actually a conflict or just some redundancy within clauses 1 and 2 on 49.33 and 50.1. I guess it's really going to be up to this conference committee how you want to handle it, whether you're going to make, give it, whether they're going to give priority and preference, or whether they're going to make available only those products. So there's a little difference. Like I said, on subdivision 2 on the House side is comparable to the way the Policy Committee worked on it, but that's tied into the exemptions that are in the bill, and you don't see those here. So if you're going to tie it into the exemptions, I think you'd want to have the exemptions be part of the same bill where you're tying it into the exemptions.
Sections 113 and 114 in the House relate to the county biological survey data from the DNR. When it's available, the commissioner of DNR must provide it to counties and cities for use in their planning activities. Section 115 relates to county environmental trust funds, and it requires the county board to make all the decisions relating to those trust funds according to law. That was a floor amendment by Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, what section is that?
Section 115 in the House side on R-20. Section 117 on the House side and R-21 is the states that the tax forfeited land exchanged in Itasca County and sold for a proposed steel mill is exempt from payment of 3% of the sales price collected by the county auditor. That was a insertion by Representative Solberg.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Senator Saxhog has this in a couple of places on the Senate side. It's in Senate File 1119 that's on the floor, and also in Senate File 1312 on the floor, the same provision exempting them from that fee.
And then R-122, the voluntary termination of timber sale permits. There's some differences here. You can see on the Senate side, 50.29, the eligible sale for timber includes a permit which was issued on or after July 1st, 2004. The House is on or after October 1st, 2004, and before March 31st, 2006. So there's a significantly in the Senate, I'm sorry, is but before January 1st, 2007. So there's a different timeline in there. And then on 9635 on the House side, for which the aspen was sold for $40 per quart or more, in the Senate side it's $50 per quart or more. And then 50.33 on the Senate side, and 34 is voluntary turnback is 10,000 cords of all species for each permittee, whereas in the House side it's 7,500 cords of all species. And then there's a little difference, a lot of similarity, but some difference in clauses D on both the House and the Senate on on the payment and the interest and so forth. And E, clause E, in the House side, if the commissioner has received a 50% down payment and meets the requirements in paragraph B, the permit holder may request a credit equal to 2/3 of the down payment. So amounts credited to permittees must first be applied to any existing sales that remain in the permittee's account and sort of and so forth. Representative Dill, who's not here, can explain this much better than I can. And he worked on this pretty extensively over the course of the session. Section 119 is the Forest Protection Plan that the Forest Resources Council was going to get $75,000 in our appropriations article for this task force to do a forest protection plan to address forest pests and establish a system of tree monitoring to do early pest detection and so forth, and a number of things, as you can see, that this task force would have to do and then report back to the legislative committees on natural resources and also to the LCCMR on December 15th, 2007. There'd be 15 members of the task force, and the commission, the representatives of DNR and Ag would be ex officio members. Section 120 in the House bills.
Madam Chair, is there there's no Senate counterpart to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, not to my knowledge. I've not seen anything on that.
Section 120, endocrine disruptor report that the commissioner of the PCA must do to prevent endocrine disruptors into waters of the state, and includes a strategy to prevent entry of endocrine disruptors and a report to the legislature.
And Madam Chair, the Senate does have something in Senator Chaudhry's Senate File 1312, although the language is a little bit different. And right now it doesn't require a report. It kind of suggests a report because there was the concern was that it couldn't have a fiscal cost in that bill. So there is a little difference in the language.
Section 121 is the easement report where the earlier appropriation was for that the Commissioner of Natural Resources has to report to the legislative committees on Environment and Natural Resources Finance with minimum legal and proposed minimum legal and conservation standards.
Money in it.
Section 122 relates to Itasca County, allows the Itasca County Auditor to lease tax forfeited land in Minnesota Steel for a 20-year period, including provision for renewal.
And Madam Chair, again, Senator Saxog has this in a couple of places. It's Senate File 1312 and 1119.
Section 123 is a wild rice study where we had an earlier appropriation that includes the current location of natural wild rice stands and potential threats to those stands and recommendations to the legislative committees on protecting natural wild rice stands in the state. Section 124 is just construction for the genetically engineered provisions, I'm sorry, for the wild rice provisions in the bill earlier that doesn't modify the authorities obligations or powers of the state or any political subdivision. This was because Native American sovereignty, and they wanted this provision in our bill because we had the wild rice provisions. Section 125 is the PCA has to establish a database of septic best practices so the public can understand better what the best practices are for septic systems. Section 126 is a rulemaking for the wetland bill. They're exempt from Chapter 14 and effective for 2 years from the date of publication in the state register. Unless they're superseded by permanent rules, there may be a similar provision in the Senate bill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, in Senate File 1312, there's a provision, although it's not identical, it's a little bit more limited in the exemption and what's being exempted from the rulemaking process, but we can see that later. That's part of the wetland discussion.
Section 127 is renaming the proposed Greenleaf Lake State Park into a state recreation area and add some land, as you can see on clauses 1 and 2 in subdivision 1. I can't remember how much land is added. It's not a great amount.
And Madam Chair, this is in also in Senate File 1312.
Section 128 is the Vermilion Highlands Wildlife Management Area in Dakota County. That was the land that was given to the state by the University of Minnesota in exchange for the proposed football stadium last year, and it includes what permitted uses in that wildlife management area would be underneath that and so forth. Section 129 is
Madam Chair, before we leave that, we do have a comparable provision in the Senate in Senator Chaudhry's 1312. You know, the big difference and is on page R128 on 102.10 through 102.17, where the House is looks like they're going to request the University of Minnesota to keep the fees that they receive from the use of the property to use for a master planning process. I think that's something that the House added to that bill.
Those would be existing agricultural lease payments, right? In order to do a master planning and resource inventory process of the land. For, as you can see, on 102.15, in order to provide needed prairie and wetland restoration and so forth. 129 is renaming a island in Pelican Lake to Strands State Island. That was a floor amendment by Representative Rukavina. Then we go on to the biomonitoring pilot program. And this is... The House provisions are in the Human Services Bill, and Senate provisions are in this bill. Pilot program, the House says 457.2, we utilize the advice from the advisory panel for the commissioner to develop the pilot program. The Senate doesn't have an advisory panel.
Special law.
The Senate language talks about on 5120, the program collects and assesses biospecimens from 100 voluntary participants that have been exposed to pure fluorinated chemicals. In the House side, in 457.11, we ask for 30 volunteer participants that the advisory panel identifies as have been exposed to a designated chemical. Further, on 4714, voluntary participants that the advisory panel identifies as likely to have been exposed to arsenic and likely to have been exposed to mercury. The Senate doesn't have that those specific chemical exposures. And there's some other differences in the voluntary participants section of this. On the next page, we've got 457.18 and 19. We say within the appropriations available for the base program. On 4726, we communicate the results of the pilot program to the public. I don't think the Senate language mentions that. We on 457.30, participation in the biomonitoring program by providing these biospecimens is voluntary and requires written and informed consent, and I don't think the Senate requires that.
Madam Chair, I see that at the top of the page on the Senate side.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay. Excuse me. And clause B under participation are similar in both sides, although on 458.2 in the House side, results are subject to the Department of Health Institutional Review Board protocols and guidelines, and I don't think the Senate language mentions that. 458.6, we've got a sentence, program administrator shall receive training in administering the program in an ethical, culturally sensitive, participatory, and community-based manner. The program guidelines are very similar, although the Senate on 52.14 has a sentence, the protocol shall be developed utilizing a scientific peer review process in a manner that is participatory and community-based in design, implementation, and evaluation. And those are basically the differences in the biomonitoring pilot program. And as I said, as I promised, we'll have a separate sheet on explaining all the differences in a better, so you can see it in a more consistent fashion. And then the last section for this, well, other than the repealers, I'm sorry, but Section 64 in the Senate side information sharing.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that's related to the biomonitoring, as I remember. And it deals with, because it says are requested to jointly develop and sign a memorandum declaring their intent to share new and existing environmental hazard exposure and health outcome data within the applicable data privacy laws. So it's tied into the biomonitoring. It was a part of that amendment on the Senate side.
And the big differences in the repealers are the Forest Resources Council, as you can see in the Senate side, is not repealed till, or the, it's sunsetted 2017. No sunset in the House, no sunset in the House for that Mineral Resources Coordinating Committee. And then 92, that's the Minerals Suspense Account. What's the account called again?
Minerals Management Account.
Right, Minerals Management Account that the House retains in its language, but the Senate repeals that effective a year from this July.
And Madam Chair, that you've got also the repeal of, one is tied to the wetlands, which is on paragraph C on 102.28. That's in the Senate, in Senate File 1312. And then also the repealer in paragraph D on the House side, that's the repealer that deals with the Greenleaf Lake State Park. And so that's also in Senate File 1312.
I'll just go on briefly to talk about Article 3, then the Science Museum and the State Zoo. The only changes are in House Side 103.9, we have a base budget for the Science Museum, $1 million each year in the 2010-2011 biennium. And then for the zoo, we have another base budget on 103.23 for the Zoological Board, $6,940,000 each year in the 2010-2011 biennium.
And, Madam Chair, the other difference on 103.21, you've got, you're continuing the lottery in lieu as a one-time appropriation to the zoo. Senate put that in the base, finally.
And that concludes.
Sorry.
We're on to energy, Madam Chair.
On to energy. Yeah. Any question before we go on to energy?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A small item in here that I question whether or not we can do. It's on R-128, the renaming of directing the legislature naming Strand State Island. I think perhaps we have a little constitutional problem doing that.
I think perhaps you're right.
Madam Chair, apparently that was a floor amendment. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Floor amendment in the House.
Certain members had knowledge of that, too.
Nice thing.
Madam Chair, why is that not constitutional?
Maybe council can help us with that.
There's a constitutional provision that only the Commissioner of Natural Resources can do a geographic name change, as I remember. And I think Mr. Knopf is getting that provision. So the legislature cannot rename a geographic feature.
Madam Chair, is there judicial interpretation of that constitutional provision to that, this effect?
I'm not sure if there is or not, Senator.
You.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, as I understand it, there's some general prohibitions on special legislation that the legislature is prohibited from passing laws to do various things, and one of them is, the legislature shall pass no law or special law authorizing the laying out, opening, altering, vacating, or maintaining of roads, highways, streets, or alleys, remitting fines, penalties, or forfeitures, changing the names, this is an appropriate one, changing the names of persons, places, lakes, or rivers. That's one of the clauses that goes on, authorizing the adoption or legitimation of children. So that it basically prohibits the legislature from passing a law that names a person or a place or a body of water.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, don't we have a bill that changes the name of a state park?
No, in that case, it's a designation of the park.
Okay.
It's a park for a recreation area.
And Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I think the distinction is we're naming what we own or what we have. It's a little bit
newly,
different.
Madam Chair, it's a newly created entity, so we're giving it a name. Yeah. Maybe that's different. We're not changing it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Chaudhry.
So the distinction in this case is that that Big Island is a private island?
Council is going to have to help again here.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know about the ownership of the island. The state designates areas that it calls state parks and state forests and does that by law. And names those in law where it's designating that area as a state forest. But as far as generally the naming of a geographic feature has been prohibited by the Constitution, as I understand how that works. In fact, Chapter 83, we had this discussion, a number of years ago when they were trying to change the use of the word squaw for Squaw Lake and various places because it was considered to be not a very nice term to use, to put mildly. So what the legislature did is it directed the DNR and local governments to go through that process. Generally, the naming of things is given to local governments and the Department of Natural Resources to do, and that's in Chapter 83. And what they did in that law was to direct the commissioner to work with people and to start renaming, but not to require the commissioner to do it by law, because that then becomes basically naming that entity or that item.
And Madam Chair, trails and roads are different. Those are not geographic locations.
Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, as I understand it, that basically... they're not geographic features. They are naming something that's created.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Knopf, I thought you, when you were reading that, I thought you said the word roads at some point.
Madam Chair, I think it's a special law. This is for a special law that would be, when I was going over that, it's maintaining, I think, and that's basically local roads, streets, and alleys, and that sort of thing. That the legislature can't pass laws naming those or vacating those. Also, the important part is that the legislature can't pass a law changing the names of persons, places, lakes, or rivers. I think that's the one that's kind of tripped up some other attempts to name things legislatively in the past.
Representative Osmond has a question.
And it's a really good constitutional provision, because as a chair, I've had several requests to try and change the names of lakes, and it would be an ongoing problem. You have people fighting you all the time as to what they want their name of their lake and everything. And so it's been wonderful to be able to go to the Constitution.
Can't do it.
Thank you.
All right.
Yes. Any more questions before we go to energy? No questions. Council, would you like to start with that? And Senate?
That would be Carol Baker.
I'll start on the right.
I'll start in, Madam Chair, if that's okay. Would you like me to start with the rider language first?
Yes, I think so. That
okay.
Would be good.
Then that starts on page R136 at the top.
I think let's, if we could start with the difference between the dollars in the Senate and the House to give some context.
Mm-hmm.
Could we get a little bit of context here first?
Sure. This provision concerns E85 cost share grants. The appropriations from the House are $2 million in each of the first 2 years. And it also specifies that the base appropriation in the 2010-2011 biennium is also $2 million. The Senate, in contrast, just appropriates $500,000 in fiscal year 2008 for those grants. Another difference is that the House language contains a provision that up to 10% of the funds can be used for similar grants for pumps dispensing biodiesel fuel, at least that's at least 10% biodiesel. That's not contained in the Senate language either. The next provision directs Xcel Energy to transfer, in the case of the House language, $2.5 million in fiscal year 2008 and $2.5 million in fiscal year 2009 to the Department of Commerce for grants to promote renewable energy. That's a total of $5 million for the biennium. The Senate language appropriates a total of $5,475,000 for the biennium for those purposes. There are some other differences. The House requires that those funds be deposited in the special revenue fund, whereas the Senate does not. And as far as the breakdown of where those monies should be spent, there are mostly similarities. $500,000 each year for capital grants for on-farm biogas recovery facilities. That's in both the House and Senate language. Also $500,000 each year for rebates for new solar electricity projects in both House and Senate language. And $500,000 each year for continued funding for community energy technical assistance and outreach with respect to renewable energy and conservation, both the House and the Senate. The one difference is the last two lines in the House language specify Article 6, Section 13, that's the program that refers to. Another difference is on the top of page R-137, the House directs that of that $2.5 million each year, $1 million each year should go for funding automotive technology projects with a special focus on plug-in hybrid vehicles. That language is not present in the Senate version.
Madam Chair, if I can just jump in and say these are all allocations from the Renewable Development Fund, so we're not creating some new requirement for Xcel in this language. I just want to be clear. Right. These are just allocations made out of that existing Renewable Development Fund.
Thank you, Senator. And maybe we might want to make that more explicit in this language.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, could I ask a question, too, about the $500,000 each year to provide rebates for solar electric projects? What type of projects are we talking about? Are we talking about rebates to homeowners for devices they might buy? Or are we talking about larger generation facilities?
My understanding that this is for homeowners rebates that currently exist now, and I believe was also governor's recommendation.
Madam Chair and Senator Frederickson, that's my understanding as well, and it's a program that's been ongoing in the Department of Commerce. It's been extremely popular, and they're out of money. There's a lot of demand, but I think it is for small individual projects.
Madam Chair, some of us are a little bit of disadvantage because we don't serve on the Energy Committee, and we have not seen
this
part of the bill before.
And I think we can just entertain more questions.
On page R-137, House has language, again, directing Xcel Energy to transfer from the Renewable Development account $3 million in fiscal year 2008, $2 million in fiscal year 2009 to the Department of Commerce, where they should be deposited in the Special Revenue Fund and appropriated for cost share grants to fund renewable energy research in Minnesota. And there's additional information on the makeup of the panel to award those grants. The comparable language from the Senate at the bottom of the page transfers $4 million in each of those 2 years. So you've got a two-year total of $8 million from the Senate versus $5 million from the House. The Senate language also just says those funds will be dispersed as grants rather than the language in the House as cost share grants. And the Senate also directs those grants to be to go to the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the University of Minnesota, and also to the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. The House language just sets up a grant program. It doesn't specify that money should be given to particular organizations.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Perhaps this would be a good time to explain this difference. This is on the House side, and I believe on the Senate side as well, part of the governor's proposal, which was for $10 million. And as you see in the Senate language, it does specifically name the Initiative for Research and Energy and the Environment. What we did on the House side in cutting down this request from the governor for funding for competitive grants is that we took IRE out of the equation. On the House side, as you will see, what we did is put IRE into the base in the Energy Division and Commerce.
Yes, that's what he did mention.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
And I appreciate it. I was going to try to clarify my understanding of that as well. So the IRE grant in the House is from general fund dollars rather than from the Renewable Development Fund. So isn't that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, that's sort of right. part of IRE funding has been from Xcel Energy through the Renewable Development Fund, and they're continuing that for 2 years. And then we pick up funding from the general fund at that point, $3 million, so that they're in the second year of the biennium, so that their funding continues at the level that it has been, which is roughly $5 million. And then after that, it would be funded from the general fund ongoing as part of the base.
And, Madam Chair, just to be clear that the research funds that were allocated above that, starting on 106.13, that the Senate did not do that piece because the Renewable Development Fund already has a process for granting out the money for renewable development projects. So we decided not to put this new process in place. We just left it at the existing process.
Sorry, Bob.
No problem. As Representative Hilty just mentioned, at the bottom of page R-137 on the House side is the $3 million that does go to IREE, and it specifies at the bottom that goes into the base budget in the 2010-2011 biennium. The top of page R-138, House language also specifies with respect to the IRE grant beginning in 2010-2011 that at least 15% of the funds must be set aside for qualified research projects conducted at a rural campus or a rural experiment station. The next provision indicates $10 million in the first year for the Renewable Hydrogen Initiative, which is currently in statutes. To fund a competitive grant program in that section. The comparable language from the Senate is for $1 million in the first year to both prepare the hydrogen roadmap and make grants under that existing section. At the bottom of page R-138, $3.1 million the first year to be deposited in a rural wind energy development revolving loan fund. The House language indicates that this appropriation does not cancel and is a one-time appropriation. The Senate language at the bottom of that page indicates $1 million in the first year for deposit into that revolving loan fund. At the top of page R-139, House language has $1 million in the first and second and the second years for a grant to the Center for Rural Policy and Development to fund a rural wind energy development program. The Senate language has the full $2 million going to the center in fiscal year 2008. on in the middle of page R-139, the House has an appropriation for $50,000 in the first year for a technical, economic, and environmental analysis of the benefits to be derived from greater use of geothermal heat pump systems in Minnesota for heating and cooling. And the rest of the language on that page and through half of page R-140 specifies what that grant should study.
Something like that on a sentence.
The bottom of page R-140, $45,000 the first year for an appropriation for a grant to the Linden Hills Power and Light to do preliminary engineering design work for a community digester and neighborhood district heating and cooling system. At the top of page R-141, $3 million the first year for the propane pre-purchase program, a one-time appropriation. There's no comparable Senate language. Below that, $4 million the first year for a one-time grant to the St. Paul Port Authority for environmental review and permitting, engineering work, and development of a steam production facility to be located in St. Paul. No comparable Senate appropriation on that. And the rest of that page talks about what those grant funds can be used for.
Madam Chair, the St. Paul Port Authority grant on the Senate side, we have a bill that just passed the Senate floor that is our provision relating to the same project. It's the Rock 10 plant biomass project, but we don't have an appropriation for that. Mm-hmm. So that just passed today, I think, or yesterday, so we don't have the language yet, but we'll get that.
Mm-hmm. At the top of page R-142, the House appropriates $150,000 the first year to Commissioner of Commerce to make grants for demonstration projects for electric vehicles with advanced transmission technologies. No comparable Senate provision on that. And then $100,000 for the first and second years appropriated to the Commissioner of Commerce for transfer to the Commissioner of Human Services to supplement the ongoing operational expenses for the Minnesota Commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. The Senate has $60,000 just for the first year for that purpose. And the Senate language indicates that the appropriation becomes part of the base level funding beginning July 1st, 2007. The House language said it's the $100,000 each year is added to the Commission's base. On page R-143.
Are we going to talk about the Senate differences?
Madam Chair, on page R-142, lines 54.22, we have some language requiring the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force to study the manufacturing processes from that possibly could happen at the St. Paul Ford manufacturing plant. The next, there's the both sides have the just a straight up appropriation for the Public Utilities Commission. Then the next couple things are House items, but compared to some items in the Senate in different parts of the bill. On the first one is on the House side, they have the one time appropriation for terrestrial and geological carbon sequestration. That's a general fund appropriation that actually goes to the DNR. On the Senate side, we have same dollar amount, but on the Senate, it comes out of the RDF account within Department of Commerce, but still directs it to the DNR. And there's language later on in the article that spells out that requirements of the grant. And on the House side, there's $60,000 also to the DNR for the Rapidam Dam feasibility study. I said it right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I heard all the giggles there. I was wondering.
Madam Chair, then the next part, the House within their energy article had a couple appropriations to the Pollution Control Agency. And in our spreadsheet, we're actually tracking these appropriations back in within the department that they will go to. In the both the Senate and the House sides. So just in the future, these will actually be rolled up to an agency that they occur in. House and the Senate both have $400,000 for the Kuching, plasma torch gasification feasibility study. And then the House has another $300,000 for the biomass gasification study.
And, yeah, Madam Chair, as I mentioned earlier, the big difference here, the House uses general fund. You see no fund specified, whereas the Senate uses the environmental fund to pay for that as part of the mining and ethanol and manufacturing permitting provision. $300,000 is in there on the Senate side.
And then the other previous study are both on the House and the Senate side from the general fund. On the Senate side, this was in our one-time bill.
And then at the top of page R-144 is the House appropriating $1 million first and second year to the Commissioner of Health for grants for lead environmental risk assessment, one-time appropriation.
And then on the...
Excuse me for just, if you could, is there a similar provision?
Madam Chair, I've checked with our health fiscal analyst to see if on the Senate side there is a similar provision. I mean, there are other Department of Health-led programs, but it doesn't seem that Senate has a similar item they line up with directly with this particular program. I mean, there's other lead abatement programs that are ongoing within the Department of Health, but this seems like it's in addition to what is currently...
I'm not understanding why it's in here.
It was in... the energy article of the House bill.
I'm sorry. Now I'm understanding, of course.
And there is still some discussion about alignment-wise, whether if we end up adopting all or part of this, whether this will end up in this bill or another bill, but that's something that will probably have to be discussed. On the Senate side, Section 7 there on page 144 is the compensation increase. Again, this is language that the Senate is carrying in all the budget bills to tie the increased general fund appropriations for each agency to a compensation increase of 3.25%. And that's it for the riders.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I can't find it in the side-by-side, but the Senate had $500,000 for the low-income heating assistance project through Commerce, and... Maybe it got left out. It was also from Senate File 2190.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as we've been, Mr. Knopf and I have noticed as we've been going through the side-by-side, there has been a couple items that were, language-wise, that were contained in Senate File 2190, the one-time funding bill, that did not appear in this, but we're tracking the money on the spreadsheet so they won't be forgotten.
Right.
Whether they get they're funded or not, we'll make sure the language gets pulled into this document. But it's one of the issues that we're pulling things from multiple bills. And when there is no comparable section in the House sometimes. But there are a couple of those provisions, but we'll make sure in the spreadsheets they're tracked there.
Okay. Moving on to the statutory provisions on energy, they begin on the bottom of page R-200.
Oh, we're going to skip over.
Finish.
You want to skip a comma?
Yeah. And they start with a number of provisions that are present only in the House language. First one, the city of Elk River is designated as the state energy city. I assume that doesn't run afoul of any constitutional.
Madam Chair, do we have a? I thought we did that in the Senate. I'm pretty sure Senator Jungbauer did something.
Yeah,
I thought it was Senator Jungbauer, but one of those two. You're right. Mm. There was a bill, so maybe we should just see if it's identical.
All right. And at the bottom of page R-200 is the employee suggestion program under the Commissioner of Administration, which rewards state employees who make suggestions that end up saving energy with cash awards up to $1,000. And that goes on through the top of page R-201. In the middle of that page, there are two sections that recognize the Monticello storage facility. and simply change existing statutes to take that into account, to apply the statutory language that already exists to the Monticello facility as well. On page R202, the Senate language is different from the House language there. On lines 56.27 through 30, indicating that Xcel will be eligible to apply for renewable development fund grants, and that they would be evaluated in the same manner as other renewable development fund grants. That language is not present in the House version. Moving down to paragraph B, the difference here is that the House is asking or is requiring $500,000 annually for each dry cask stored at Monticello, so long as the plant is in operation, and $7.5 million for each year the plant is not in operation. And the Senate language asks for $350,000 for each cask when the plant is in operation, and $5.25 million each year the plant is not in operation. And the paragraph at the bottom of the page is pretty much the similar ideas in slightly dissimilar language. Moving on to page R203. This is House language doing a couple of things. One, it increases the amount coming from the renewable development account that's going to pay for renewable energy production incentives, and also as a result of this provision and some following, a new renewable grant program for on-farm biogas projects. The way the money is allocated is up to $5,000 in incentive payments can now go to landfill gas programs, which currently is not the case under current statute. Another $500,000 used for incentive programs for on-farm biogas projects, and $1 million for a new on-farm biogas grant program. At the bottom of that page on the Senate is language with respect to recovery of by a nuclear generating plant that is making infrastructure changes that will reduce greenhouse gases. That language is currently not in the House version.
Madam Chair,
yes,
I just want to point out that this language, after the omnibus bill, Senate bill passed, we had a hearing on this language in the Senate Energy Committee, and we modified this language in a way that I think is preferable and that is agreed to by other parties, so all the parties. So I would at some point want to include that language, the modified language. That it narrows it and it applies, I mean, it narrows what you can get cost recovery for, but it also makes gas utilities eligible as well as Xcel.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing on page R204, this section regards the money that goes to IRE from Xcel, and amends the activities, the renewable development research activities that those funds can be spent on to reflect their current and future research. And that continues at the top of page R205. Then we've got a identical language in both the House and the Senate regarding the renewable hydrogen provisions that essentially change what used to be demonstration projects now for deployment of hydrogen fuel cells and related technologies when that's found to be feasible. And that language is identical, as is the language on the following page, R206, which essentially does the same thing, change demonstration language to be deployment language.
Look at this. We do have to take just a small break here to recognize Representative Osmond.
This is it's Arbor Day.
And Representative McNamara, Hansen, Solberg, and myself provide trees for the House members, and we brought enough down for all the conferees.
Oh, does that mean that the House is now adjourned?
Yes, the House is now adjourned.
And Madam Chair, can we go home and plant them?
Yes. My first one is planted on my property. It was given to me by Willard Munger, Representative Munger, years and years ago. It's a great big tree now.
Wow.
So plant them in a good spot. You always have good memories.
What kind of tree?
Thank you.
It's a red pine.
Pine?
I still have my Willard Munger tree,
take
too,
that up
on the funeral. Actually, I think he got them.
Okay, members, if we can reconcentrate here.
Top
the sun is shining, and it's going to be—it's going to be hard to do that. I know.
Thank you, Dan.
Sorry. Thank you so much.
What do? We just put it in the ground.
Yeah, I probably even have a little two here.
What?
Sorry for the interruption.
I think they even have a little.
No, we're not. Very nice. We're not.
Okay. I wish we had enough for everyone.
Thank you.
All right. If we could start again.
Sure. On page R207 now, the Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Initiative. This is language. I referred previously to funding for the roadmap. Subdivision 1 at the top of the page describes what that is. Basically, it's going to establish vision, goals, timelines, and strategies for working with industry and measurable milestones to achieve the state's renewable hydrogen goal. This is identical language, except for some reason on the words "general timeline" on 174.7 in the House and 5923 in the Senate are in a different place. But it's all there.
Sounds irresolvable.
Yeah, I think so. Page R208. Towards the bottom of the page. Both the House and the Senate extend the expiration date of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. The House extends that date to June 30th, 2008, and the Senate extends it to June 30th, 2012. At the bottom of the page, the House has language regarding the clean energy resource teams that have been in existence for a number of years, but I think this is their first appearance in statute. And the rest of page R209 describes their powers and duties and the assistance that they get from the Department of Commerce. And there's no comparable Senate language on that provision. Page R210 describes the Rural Wind Energy Development Revolving Loan Fund. It's almost identical language. In the House on line 177.4, it specifies a particular subdivision and paragraph of that section, and that's not in the Senate language. The House on line 177.6 talks about money may be used to make loans. The Senate language talks about providing with loans. And another difference in the Senate language on lines 60.30 and 31 says the commissioner may pay reasonable and actual costs of administering the loan program, not to exceed interest earned on fund assets. That's language that's not in the in the House version.
Yes. So nice to you.
On page R211, this is House language that incorporates those changes from the RDF fund that I talked about earlier. This specifically, it's actually on the top or on the top of page R212. It's the last paragraph there. This allows qualified landfill gas recovery facilities to receive renewable energy production incentives. And same thing for the next paragraph on R212. Qualified landfill gas recovery facility can also receive those incentives. Page 213, those changes are also designed to allow that and define what a qualified on-farm biogas recovery facility is. The other change that's happening here is that essentially anaerobic digesters are now, under this language, would be eligible for receiving production incentives if they produce gas. It's not necessary now for them to produce electricity, which the current statute requires. And, okay, beginning on R213 and continuing on R214 is that new on-farm biogas recovery grant program that was for which appropriations were made for $1 million for each year. And that just describes how that's going to work.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if there was any Senate bill on any of this. Does anyone know?
Madam.
I guess I'm on the Energy Committee, so I don't remember it. I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Mr. Edelof, this is for all from the Westrum bill?
Yes.
And I think, Madam Chair, I looked, and I think there was no Senate companion to that bill on the,
I don't believe
all.
So.
It was just a Senator Westrum, or excuse me, Representative Westrum side.
Mm-hmm. On page R215 is language from the House that says that wind energy conversion systems are not a private or public nuisance after 2 years from the date that they begin generating electricity. Once they begin generating electricity, there's a rebuttable presumption that they're not a nuisance. I guess there's 2 years allowed for that to be challenged. At the very bottom of page R215 and continuing on 216, regarding petroleum violation escrow funds, this provision allows for those funds to be used, which are currently only allowed to be used for loans, I believe, for grants to K-12 schools for both energy conservation and renewable energy projects. And there's not a comparable Senate provision on that. At the bottom of R-216 are further descriptions of what we talked about in the rider, the Rural Wind Energy Development Program, the grant to the Center for Rural Policy, and Development, which will make a further grant to a nonprofit to organize and implement that program. There are some small language differences, but the thrust of this is the same in both bills. And that continues on page R217 as well. Again, some small language difference, but the ideas are very much the same. Moving on to...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm really not familiar with this either.
Mm-hmm. This is a program that essentially is going to set up... Well, if Representative Knuth is here, it was her bill. She may want to speak to it.
Which, the Rural Wind?
Yeah, the Rural Wind Development Program.
No. I'm talking about the one above that. That's my bill, too. The Rural Wind Development Program is my bill.
Mm-hmm. What page?
I'm very familiar with it. I'm talking about the petroleum escrow fund.
Oh, well, these are funds that the state received back in the 1980s through essentially court cases at the federal level when petroleum was still price regulated, and the companies were found to be overpricing under the regulations, and states recovered funds that were used for energy purposes. And in Minnesota, they've been used to make loans for energy conservation. This program allows grants, those mm-hmm. funds to be used for grants for both conservation and for renewable development projects for K-12 schools.
Okay, I think this is Representative Saylor's.
This is actually...
She mentioned something like...
I think Representative Westrum had this one.
Oh, this is his?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So yes. I don't know which one is hers.
It was all in the same bill. It's all from House File 2246.
Madam Chair, do any of you... Are we still getting money from those court cases?
I don't believe we're still getting money, but I think we have money that hasn't been used yet, and we continue to earn interest on it.
I think historically... Like half of the money went to the LCMR, and the other half went to this program, city money?
I just don't know.
Can we check on that in the meantime?
Yeah.
And LCMR, we keep thinking we've seen the last of it, and then about the time we think it's run its course, we receive another little sum of money.
Okay.
We'll check on that. Good catch.
Okay, on page R-218, There's that $500,000 for home energy heating assistance in the middle of the page on the Senate side. Okay. One thing in the paragraph above, and this is still on the Rural Wind Development Program, just a language thing. On line 183.34, it's talking about the center must use best practices. Again, it's going to that Center for Rural Policy and Development. And on line 17.2, the Senate language is the initiative. So I think we'll need to change that. Mm-hmm. At the bottom of the page, section 22, this is requiring the Commissioner of Labor and Industry and Commerce and any other relevant interest to develop recommendations to make sure that uniform codes and standards are adopted for hydrogen infrastructure. And that continues on the top of page R219. Section 23 specifies that hydrogen refueling station grants may also be used to deploy and encourage commercially promising renewable hydrogen production systems in partnership with industry, and that grants made for refueling stations can also be used for those purposes. And section 24 requires the Commissioner of Commerce to convene a group of interested stakeholders to look at the feasibility and the potential in the state for interconnecting off-site renewable distributed generation. At the top of page R220.
Madam Chair, what is this?
Yes.
Off-site renewable distributed off of what site? Do you know what that's
off means? Off-site of the rather than maybe the easiest way to explain is by example. Rather than Target building a wind tower next to their store, this would allow Xcel Energy to build a wind tower somewhere and send the energy to Target.
Okay.
At the top of page R220, section 1 requires the PCA and DNR and EQB to report on the process of issuing permits for biofuel production facilities, and states what that report should include.
Madam Chair, before you move on, there's a like provision in Senator Chaudhry's Senate File 1312 for this, and I think the language is identical.
Okay. Section 2, and these are provisions that are identical in both bills, that both the terrestrial and geologic carbon sequestration studies that the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Geological Society are undertaking. That's similar language on both R220 and 221 and the top of page 222. That's $475,000 for both studies. At the bottom of R-222, we have a series of bills now dealing with heating assistance and utilities. The first one requiring a series of or requiring monthly reports with specific pieces of information in them, mostly relating to past due accounts and things like that. This is language that's identical in both the House and Senate. R-223 continues that bill. At the very bottom is the propane pre-purchase program, which is also identical language, I believe, in both bills, which would allow the Commissioner of Commerce to purchase propane in summer months when the price is low and then use it in the winter for people who qualify for low-income heating assistance. At the bottom of page R-224 is language regarding changes in the cold weather rule for public utilities. And there are some language differences on page R-225. For example, the House at lines 190.6 through .8 has a definition of customer's income that is not in the Senate version. And similarly, the Senate on lines 2.1 through 2.13 has a definition of summary of rights and responsibilities that's not in the House version.
Madam Chair, this is my bill, and I think most of these bills are separate bills in the Senate side, and I don't know. I assume they don't have a separate companion in the House side. They're all in the omnibus bill. But the cold weather rule bill, we just passed it in the Senate, and there were some modifications that were agreed to by all parties that were adopted on the Senate floor. So again, we need to bring that, well, that's what this language is on the Senate side.
Mm-hmm. And this bill is continuing on pages R 226, 227, 228. And all the way to 230. And yes, there are some differences in language. For example, on page R 230 on the House version, there's a subdivision 9 that doesn't seem to have comparable Senate language. But on the Senate side, at the bottom of the page, there's a subdivision 8A that isn't present in the House bill. So, but beginning on page R 231, which is language relating to essentially cold weather rule procedures for cooperative electric associations and municipal utilities, that I believe is identical language on 231, 232. Also identical language on R-233 for dealing with undercharges at the top of the page, and also for the changes made in intervener compensation beginning on R-233, which increases the potential amount from $20,000 to $50,000 and specifies what criteria need to be met in order for an organization to qualify to receive intervener compensation, what procedures the public utility will adopt to make sure that gets done. That language is similar on R-234, 235, and also R-236, which brings us to R-237. And there are some differences here. The Senate is repealing Minnesota rules in Part 7820, which I believe refers to the cold weather rule. And those rules are not well, in the House language, it says the Commission must amend rules in Chapters 7820 to conform with the provisions of this statute. The only thank you, Representative Hilty. Point out on page R-236 in the House, there is language requiring Excel to include in its integrated resource plan these pieces of information with respect to the Northern Flood Agreement between the communities in Manitoba that have been affected by flooding from Manitoba Hydro Project. This requires that information be provided to the Public Utilities Commission by Excel when in its resource plan.
So, Madam Chair, has this gone through the Foreign Relations Committee?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, like the two resolutions we passed on the Senate floor today.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I'd say it's in the process of that.
That's really concludes the energy portion of this side by side.
Are there questions before we, other than foreign relations? Should we go on to the next part?
Madam Chair and members, the next part is the what's called the Commerce article. It starts on page R-144. And this article basically involves the functions of the Commerce Department other than the energy-related functions, including banks and insurance companies and other kind of business regulation. Section, and you can see that the Senate file that this article, there's nothing from this article in the Senate version of this bill. The side-by-side matches it up when it does with the Senate version of Senate File 2089, which is the Jobs and Economic Development this bill, and there are a couple of similarities there. Section 1 is a data practices cross-reference to some sections later in the article, and I'll explain that group of sections when we get to that. Section 2 is the same. It's a cross-reference issue to something later. Section 3 is the sort of base section for the licensed technology surcharge. This is a system that is used to keep track of continuing education and similar requirements for three types of licensees of the Commerce Department: insurance agents, real estate agents, and real estate appraisers. And they now pay for this system, which the Department of Commerce contracts with a vendor for. They pay with a credit card each time they use the system. So if they record continuing education credits they got, they pay for it as they go. And same thing if they change their name or their address or anything like that. And these professions want to just pay a flat amount. And so what this does is set up a system where they pay up to $40 as a surcharge on their license fee every 2 years, and then that is covered, and the vendor gets paid that way instead of in little amounts at a time. And this is you can see on lines 113.27 and 113.28, this sets up a special account in the special revenue fund. So the money goes into this and goes out of it, and it's a blinker kind of thing. You can see down on lines 114.123 and 4 that this fund is never supposed to reach a level of $2 million, and if it does, the commissioner can either sort of declare a holiday period for new surcharges or reduce the surcharge so as to keep excessive balances from accumulating in it. But it's under this, it can never be more than $40 for a two-year license period. The next section is
Madam Chair, can I just ask Mr. Sting? Oh, is this the same bill that you're going on to next? I just want to make sure we know the Senate position on each bill as we go.
I am going on to something different, so maybe Mr. Sting wants to.
Madam Chair, Mr. Penner, are you going section by section, or because it's all mixed, all the bills are mixed up in the article? So
I'm going section by section, but
so it may be somewhat tough to. maybe at the end I can sum up where the Senate is at in some of this.
Well, where you find things that are very similar, let's.
Okay. Do it as we go.
Yes, because I think, don't you think?
Oh, it's really. Yeah, it'll be really hard for Madam Chair for us to
track it.
Keep
you
track don't. Otherwise, yeah. So it might be a little slower. But okay, if you can do that. Jump in.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Madam Chair, Section 3 is part of Section. I'm sorry, Senate File 1628 in the Senate. That bill's in the Finance Committee, and it's identical.
And that's. Can you tell us the Senate authors, please?
It's Senator Scheid. In fact, all sections relating to this technology surcharge, which Mr. Penner will get to as he goes through the article, there's a couple minor differences in effective dates, but other than that, the language is identical.
Madam Chair, the next section, which is at top of page R146, is again a cross-reference change to something we get to later, so I'll just skip over that one. Also, Section 5, similarly, and Section 6, maybe now I'll start talking about these debt management service providers. A large number of the sections in this article relate to this, and partly it's because what's being done here is to repeal our existing laws regulating those kind of companies and start from scratch because the changes were so significant. So that explains quite a few of this. But this, again, is a sort of a cross-reference kind of change here. In fact, I think I will go on to the later one before I go into those kind of businesses in detail.
Would you want to tell us who had this bill in the...
Yes, Representative Davney.
That's what I thought, okay.
And I don't know where that bill is in the Senate.
Do you know?
Yeah, Madam Chair, in the Senate, Senator Scheid's carrying it. It's Senate File 1532. It's on general orders. There are some differences between the bills. The main difference in the Senate is there's a amendments came on in the committee that set up a different category of service provider called a debt settlement provider, and some somewhat different regulation was proposed for that for those service providers. I think that's the main difference between the two bills.
Madam Chair, the next section here is, let's see, we're on to section 7. This is a provision allowing state banks to borrow a higher percentage of their assets than they can now from Federal Home Loan Bank System. They can borrow up to 25% now, and this increases it to 35%, which matches what federally chartered banks can borrow. This has not been controversial. Section 8 deals with payday loans and the kind of charges or civil penalties they can assess against people who write a check that turns out to not be good when it's when they try to cash it. And this is a situation where somebody gets a payday loan and pays for it with a post-dated check, so they'll date the check for 2 weeks in the future or whatever when their payment is due, and then if they don't make that repayment, then the payday lender has that check. And what this says is that in that kind of situation, that the payday lender can recover the check and recover the cost of law enforcement expenses and so on, but can't assess the civil penalty that's allowed in law, which is $100 or the amount of the check, whichever is greater. And I think the idea is that it's, you know, if you're taking a check that's post-dated well, I guess I don't really know the rationale for it, but I assume it's something like that. But it just sort of seems unfair to pile on. I I'm not curious enough. I haven't asked anybody why this provision is in here. But it came from the Department of Commerce, and they regulate payday lenders. On R-150, Section 9 is the same thing, matching provision dealing with those post-dated checks. Section 10 at the bottom of page R-151 deals with ATM machines. When ATM machines first started to be used, the Department of Commerce wanted to know about each one of them that was being established. And they have decided they don't need to know that. They haven't been using the information. And this eliminates a requirement like this that applies to out-of-state financial institutions. And there's another one later in the bill that repeals it for in-state financial institutions. So they just don't want the information. The next two sections, starting on page R-152, involve health savings accounts. A year or two ago, we added health savings accounts to the kind of things that state-chartered banks and credit unions and similar entities could handle. The federally chartered ones are allowed to under federal law, and so this allows them to do it under state law. But I think people didn't figure out that they also needed authorization to do this through other than savings accounts, which is how they do used to doing similar things like 401k accounts and things like that, or not 401k, IRA accounts. And so this allows them to do this with transaction-type accounts, which I think are sort of interest-bearing checking accounts because there's money going in and going out all the time, and it doesn't work to do that with savings accounts. The next section is R153, Section 13. This starts the sections dealing with what are called mortgage originators. Minnesota started regulating them about 6 or 7 years ago, and this is a sort of a beefing up of those laws because of what's gone on in the market in recent years. This comes from the Department of Commerce, and mortgage originators are just to keep it simple. They're either mortgage lenders or they're mortgage brokers. Most of the ones that are subject to this are mortgage brokers who arrange loans with mortgage lenders. And banks and credit unions and similar kinds of financial institutions are exempt from this law, either because we can't regulate the federal ones, and therefore we also exempt the equivalent state ones that are regulated in their other activities anyway. Here we have on line 122.33, we have a new requirement that these kind of people that hold these kind of licenses have to be a business entity. You can't just do it as an individual. You have to have a partnership or limited liability company or corporation or something like that. And also, you see here there is basically what you could call a financial responsibility requirement starting on line 122.5. You either have to be approved as a mortgage lender by HUD or Fannie Mae, and you have to have a lot of capital to meet their requirements, or you have to show a minimum worth of at least $250,000. And the Department of Commerce requires, audited financial statements to prove that the business really has that much in net worth, or a letter of credit in the amount of $100,000, and I think that the Senate version of this is down to $50,000 on that particular thing, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Pender's going through the Department Predatory Lending Bill, I just point out that this bill in the Senate is dead. It got out of the Commerce Committee with the reduction to $50,000 on the surety bond, as Mr. Pender indicated, but it was limping fairly badly out of Commerce. And Senator Scheid, I did not pursue it any farther in the Judiciary Committee. So that's sections, I think, that he's addressing right now.
Madam Chair, maybe I'll move a little faster through this then.
Madam Chair, maybe I can ask Mr. Stang if you know if any of the sections of this predatory lending bill overlap with the other two predatory lending bills that passed the Senate. Do they have provisions in common, or maybe?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. I think they're all stand on their own, and there's no overlap.
That's correct in the House, too, Madam Chair. We have the similar two bills, and there's not overlap.
Thank you.
I'll just move quickly here. The next few sections eliminate exemptions that are in current law for these kind of licenses, and since they apply to individuals, they're irrelevant now because you have to be a business entity. Moving right along here, page R156 basically lays out what has to be in the application to be a mortgage originator, and it's consistent with the requirements that were stated earlier. I think I'll just keep skipping it because it's basically conforming kinds of things here. Cover on page R158, line 126.17. There's an education requirement that requires that people before they, and this applies of course to actually individuals, human beings who are doing the work and not these business entities that are getting the licenses, but people working for them have to have at least 15 hours of training in making these kind of loans and focusing on complying with federal and state laws. The next group of sections starts with Section 22, line 126.22, and these sections involve what are called vehicle protection products, and you can see in the right-hand column here we finally hit things that are in the Senate bill that's being compared with here, the Jobs and Economic Development bill. And I think the clearest way to see what this is to go on to the next page and look at lines 127.10 and 127.18, and you can get a sense of what these kind of products are. They're basically things designed to either protect your car from getting stolen or damaged, or if it does get stolen, to maybe make it more likely that you're going to get it back. These provisions together, basically what they do is this is a sort of like an insurance type product, because it's warranting that these products are not going to malfunction, that they're going to work like they're supposed to, and if they don't work like they're supposed to, your car might get stolen as a result of, you know, your ignition switch lock not working or something like that. So it's involves insurance against a fairly large loss, like might be, you know, the total loss of your car and never getting it back. And so this is a sort of an insurance-like product. And I think what went on here is that the industry and the Department of Commerce sort of negotiated what parts of insurance regulation need to be in place for these people and what parts wouldn't necessarily apply, and that this language kind of reflects what was worked out there. And I'll just say basically the short version of it is that it makes sure that there's something backing up the warranty that is being made to the customer here, and so the manufacturer or whoever is making the warranty has to either have a warranty insurance policy that will cover 100% of any bad things that happen, or the person making the warranty has to prove that the company has enough financial strength to back up the warranty. That's basically what's involved here. So I'm just going to skip ahead a few pages here. Then there's disclosure language requiring what kind of disclosure has to be given. That's on page R163. And there's on page R164 there in the middle of the page, you can see that they're unless the warrantor is actually licensed as an insurance company, they're forbidden to use the word insurance or any similar words in their name that would make people think that they're a real insurance company instead of just a warrantor of this kind of product. And there are record-keeping requirements, so the Department of Commerce can audit them to make sure they're complying with what they're doing. And there's an interesting little sentence in starting on line 133.25, this is on page R165, that says, a failure of any person to comply with this chapter before its effective date is not admissible in any court proceeding, administrative proceeding, arbitration, or alternative dispute resolution proceeding, and may not otherwise be used to prove that the action of any person, you know, was unlawful or otherwise improper. So in other words, you can't use this law as a standard for what behavior should have been before this law was enacted. I'm going on to page R166 here at the this page. This is a
Madam Chair. I just point out that the Senate language on the vehicle product protection warranties that Mr. Penner just outlined is the same.
And what about the effective date?
The effective date, it was carried at the end of the bill, so it is the same.
It is the same.
It is the same.
Then R166. This is the new requirement that is recommended by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners for insurance agents. We've started calling them insurance producers now in our laws, even though nobody, you know, knows them by that term. I'll just keep referring to them as insurance agents. That before they can sell long-term care insurance, they have to have training in the new long-term care insurance partnership products that basically involve if you buy $100,000 worth of long-term care insurance and you end up using it up, then if you're running out of assets, you get to keep $100,000 of your assets and still be eligible for medical assistance. So it's something that Minnesota has decided in the last couple of years to participate in, and it's an incentive for people to buy long-term care insurance. And this requires that insurance agents now, if they're going to sell any kind of long-term care insurance product, whether it's a partnership policy or something else, they have to have training in long-term care insurance, which is not now required. Now you can get an accident and health insurance license and not have had any training in long-term care insurance, even though that's included in a category of accident and health insurance. So you have to have training specifically in it, and it's 8 hours of training initially and then at least 4 hours every 2 years after that.
Madam Chair, in the Senate, that provision was carried in Senator Scheid's technology surcharge bill, SF-1628, and is the same.
The next item is on R-167, and this is one that relates to the technology surcharge that I talked about earlier. And this is simply the way this is set up. That initial section set up the surcharge, and then there's specific sections that apply it to specific professions. And this is the first of those, and it applies it to insurance agents. And then the next sections, starting section 35, starting on page R-168, this is the beginning of several sections that deal with auto insurance and increase the benefits that are available under auto insurance in terms of how much you get paid per week that you're out of work, and how much you get paid or your family gets paid if you die and a funeral is needed, and so on. I'm quite sure this is a bill has not progressed in the Senate.
No, Madam Chair, that's correct. None of these no-fault auto changes were even heard in the Senate.
And, Madam Chair, who is the author?
I believe in the Senate.
Yeah.
Mary Olson, I think.
Okay. And Madam Chair, in the House, Representative Atkins is the House author of these provisions. I don't know how much time to spend on this since it's not active in the Senate. Section on page R-170, section 39, this involves stacking of automobile insurance policies, and this has been somewhat controversial. We have the ability now, when we buy an auto insurance policy, to stack our no-fault benefits. So if you have two cars and you have the required amount of no-fault medical coverage of $20,000 per car. If you want to, you can pay a little extra amount and stack them so that if you have an accident with one of those cars, you can collect the $20,000 on that car and the $20,000 on the other car that you're stacking it with. And that's available as an option now when people buy auto insurance. And what this bill does is say that that's the default. And you're offered the option to not stack, and you're told then you can save some money if you choose not to stack. So it's a change in the status quo point.
Madam Chair, did we have a Senate bill that was similar? I thought I saw one a couple of days ago.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, no, we did not hear this provision in the Senate.
Hey, Council, if you could remind me on when you went back to the medical expense benefits, the disability benefits, how long has it been since these have been updated?
Madam Chair, I forget which is the Madam Chair here. I
think well, it doesn't matter.
I was going to say Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius. So. No. Okay, Madam Chair, the No-Fault Act was enacted in 1974, and the current wage loss benefit was increased slightly once in the early 1980s and has not been increased since then. You can see it on line 136.23. It's a maximum of $250 per week under current law, and I think it was originally $200 when it was enacted in '74 and was increased to $250 in the early 1980s and hasn't been increased since then.
And that would be similar with the burial expenses, et cetera, or not?
Madam Chair, yes, it's similar. None of these have been updated any time in recent years.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Section 40 is also part of that same law and involves a situation where an insurance company has told someone they're denying benefits for something. Either they think there's no further treatment that will benefit the person, or it's just not covered, or whatever. And then the insured sometimes just stops sending their medical bills into the company, and then later they maybe appeal the decision not to cover the benefits. And under current law, the insurance company then can sometimes deny payment of the benefits that weren't submitted because there's a requirement that any claims be submitted promptly. And the insured understandably stopped submitting them because the insurance company said they weren't going to pay they'd been paying some, but they weren't going to pay any more. So this says that if the on lines 138.15, if the insurer notifies the insurer that it's denying benefits, the insurer doesn't have to continue to provide the proof of the expenses. Section 41 regulates healthcare providers in terms of how they can contact auto accident victims, and if you've been in an auto accident, some of you maybe received letters the next day from various healthcare providers recommending you come in and get checked out just in case you maybe had some injury. And what this does is regulate the kinds of contacts they can make. They can't contact people over the telephone, for instance, and other kinds of restrictions on the methods of contact. If they contact them by mail, it has to be clearly spelled out that this is an advertisement and so on. And there was a floor amendment to add attorneys to this. That was Representative Zeller's amendment. So they're also subject to these same restrictions under this provision. The next section 42, is a House floor amendment by Representative Rukavina dealing with auto glass shops. And this is a longstanding dispute between auto insurance companies and auto glass shops that are in their preferred networks and auto glass shops that are not in their preferred networks. And they've been fighting for years over the language here that you see at the bottom of pages page R-174, right at the bottom of that page, R-174. That's the language, and this is an attempt to amend that language to move the situation among those three groups in one direction or another. As I say, this has been under dispute ever since auto companies started to set up preferred glass networks, it's an ongoing battle. Sections going on to page R-175, sections I might just add the Rukavina amendment had not been introduced as a separate bill in the House, so it was not heard. The next sections that start on page R175 and go on to the next couple of pages, this involves the mutual fund registration fees, where we require mutual fund companies to pay a registration fee equal to a percentage of the value of the shares that they think they're going to be selling in Minnesota to Minnesota residents. And about 6 years ago, we enacted a provision capping that, the total amount collected in that way, at $25 million. And then there's a kind of a refund kind of procedure where if the amount that comes in is over 125, it gets rebated to these mutual fund companies on a pro rata basis. And these two sections together eliminate the $25 million cap. The governor's budget did propose increasing the cap to $25,600,000. And so this goes further and eliminates the cap. And the reason there are two sections here is that the first one, Section 43, amends a statute that expires on August 1st of 2007, and Section 44 amends the one that replaces it, which is pretty much identical. We just enacted a new version of the securities laws last session, and it was easier to just repeal all the old ones and reenact enact the new ones, even though some sections were identical. And the Senate Omnibus Jobs and Economic Development bill, you can see, has the first section that repeals this August and doesn't have the second one. The next things start on page 178, and the first one, Section 46, applies a technology surcharge to real estate brokers and salespersons. And the one section after that applies it to real estate appraisers. Actually, the first section that applies it to realtors, I knew there were two of them. The first section is in the bottom of page R177. We needed two sections there to do it. Then section 48 on line 146.17 deals with the collateral that has to be posted by banks to secure deposits by local governments, and it changes the situation to allow the use of either rated or unrated securities if the securities are actually those of that local government. So if the collateral being posted is that local government's own securities, they don't need to be either rated or unrated.
Madam Chair,
yes.
And can I just ask this, going back to the technology fee, does that apply to attorneys under this?
Representative Anderson, no, it applies only to real estate agents, real estate appraisers, and insurance agents. It may apply to later, you know, other professions at some time later that are regulated by the Department of Commerce. But right now, it's just these three because those are the only ones that have continuing education requirements, and that's the main feature of this.
Madam Chair, members, this is a bill that. It was authored by Representative Knuth, and if there are questions about it that you have, she obviously is available to answer them as well as Mr. Pender.
Madam Chair, on page R179, Section 49, this allows auto insurers to submit complaints to licensing boards, health provider licensing boards, if a health provider violates the requirement about how to contact auto victims. Section 50 on page R179 deals with petroleum inspection fees. This was a bill authored in the House by Representative Saylor. And it allows funds collected from that fee to be used for low-income weatherization services.
That's part of the no-fault stuff.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Just to Mr. Pender, the The part that you just mentioned a moment ago about auto insurers violating those standards, is that in the no-fault bill as well?
Yes, it is,
ma'am.
Senator Anderson. Section 51 at the bottom of page R-179 is a requirement that dealers or distributors of liquid propane or fuel oil not discriminate against people who are enrolled in the low-income home energy assistance program, and that only applies if that retailer or distributor has contracted with that program to make deliveries to those people.
Is there a similar Senate provision here?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. These would have been energy provisions. Went through the Energy Committee,
I'm pretty sure there is, Madam Chair. This was in a bill of mine last year, as were most of these other energy policy things that are all, and I think they all are going separately, but I can't remember for sure if this one was passed again in the Senate this year. But I think it was, but I can't remember whose bill it was. Okay. Can you tell us? He's nodding. You can talk. Mr. Jurofsky.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, members. This was very similar to the bill that you passed through the Senate last year, and I'm told that the language here is slightly different from your bill from last year, but the current language is in Senator Rosen's bill, which also encompasses the other pre-buy part that we talked about of propane.
So, Madam Chair, so it's passed the Senate.
Yeah.
This language has passed the Senate this year.
Okay.
That's all.
Madam Chair, the next group of sections involve debt management services providers. These are people we until now we've been calling them debt prorating businesses in statute. This is the business where we're repealing all the existing laws and enacting from scratch because we're making such significant changes. This was recommended by Legal Aid. The Legal Advocacy Project, and these are businesses that contract with people who are in serious financial difficulties and try to work out a deal with their creditors to stretch out the payments or make other kinds of concessions to basically give people an alternative to bankruptcy and to try to sort of salvage the situation if people are doing this right, they're first analyzing the customer's situation thoroughly so that they can decide whether, what's appropriate to do with the situation. The main change involved in these new laws is that for the first time we're applying our registration requirement and other regulations to out-of-state businesses that are doing this kind of business with Minnesota customers, typically over the internet or by telephone or by mail. And in the past, we've only regulated the ones that have a physical presence here, that have an office here. So this is expanding the scope of what we regulate. And on page R-180, there's an exemption in current law from the do not call law for nonprofit organizations. And here we say unless the organization is a debt management services provider, because many of these people are nonprofits and feel like these are more, I guess the feeling is these are more like private sector businesses that shouldn't be allowed to call people who haven't wanted to have contact with them. The next section is a cross-reference change. Down at the bottom of page R-183, dealing with the fees. Now, this is a different kind of organization. In section 54, this is the fees that are charged for what are called credit services organizations. And these are what I've typically referred to as credit repair organizations, where if somebody has bad credit and they're not able to get loans, there are companies that say that they will be able to repair the person's credit situation by either eliminating incorrect information in their credit report or telling them what day of the month to make their credit card payments or close certain accounts or whatever they think might help the person's situation, and this is a fee increase requested by the Department of Commerce because they say it reflects the cost of regulating these people better to have a fee of $1,000 instead of $100. Then we start on the top of page R-184, we start the sections dealing with the recodification of the regulation of the debt management services providers. And as we said before, this is Representative Davney's bill in the House. And I don't think I'll go through all the details of it unless you want me to, but it defines terms and says who has to be registered, and it does apply to out-of-state firms for the first time, and it just generally beefs up regulation in terms of giving the Commissioner of Commerce authority to examine these companies' books and records. And as a necessary part of that, we have a law requiring them to keep books and records. And in general, gives the department much stronger authority to regulate these people. And I don't know how much detail you want me to go into here, but it basically these companies have to be registered, and as you can see on page R-191, the commissioner can take action against them to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew their registration. And there are a lot of requirements as we go on to page R-191 and the pages that follow about what has to be in a written debt management services agreement between the customer and the company, where they have to promise, you know, spell out what they're going to do and what the customer's rights are in terms of canceling the contract if the customer doesn't want to continue with it, and other kinds of things where it's either requiring that certain consumer protection clauses be put in the contracts or saying that certain things can't be in the contract because they'd be unfair to the consumer. And if we just go on here, R-194 deals with the books and records I already mentioned. There's section 66 on page R-195 dealing with fees and advance payments and regulating that. So it's just a much stronger and more comprehensive regulation of these kind of entities. And I think I'll just not go into any further detail on that unless you want me to. And
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to wake everyone up here, what does a I'm talking about the topic, not the presentation. What is an example of a debt management service? Can you give me examples? That
this would be a company if somebody's in financial crisis where they have creditors calling them all the time and they can't pay their bills and they're being threatened with garnishment or other kinds of remedies, foreclosure, they'll go in and see one of these people and get a financial assessment of their situation and basically to try to determine whether it's salvageable, whether it's something that if they can stretch out their payments or negotiate lower interest rates for a while or somehow help them get back on their feet. Maybe they've had a temporary problem because they were unemployed for a while and now they have a job again and they just sort of need extra time to get caught up. So basically it involves working out a deal with the creditors. And usually the way this works then is that once the deal is worked out with the creditors, then the customer pays one monthly amount to this company, and then they divide it up among the creditors. And so it's sort of, and then the phone calls don't happen anymore as long as the payments keep getting made every month, and the debtor sort of gets a respite and a chance to get back on his or her feet again. And obviously, sometimes it ends up working, and sometimes it doesn't.
So, Madam Chair, is that, are we talking about loan consolidation, basically? Or that can include that and other things?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, it could include that. A loan consolidation thing would usually involve taking out a new loan and paying off a lot of other loans, trying to consolidate them into one loan. And this usually does not involve that. It involves keeping the existing loans in place but getting some special concessions for a period of time from the lenders. But certainly the consolidation loan could be a better alternative in some situations.
Okay. It says, and many of these can be nonprofits?
Yes.
Okay. Are student loan consolidation companies, are at least some of them, nonprofit as well?
Madam Chair and Representative and Senator Chaudhry, I don't know. I think that Sallie Mae, for instance, was until sometime recently. But my impression is most student lenders are not nonprofit. There may be some. I don't know very much about that.
Okay.
Mark.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to kind of repeat what I said earlier, Senator Scheid is carrying the companion to this bill. It's SF-1532. It's on general orders. There are some differences. The one of most note is probably the bill. The Senate bill takes a subset of this group called a debt settlement provider and subjects that animal to certain different regulations. I don't think we need any more than that.
Until it passes before, I think that's a good choice.
Madam Chair, then just to finish up on page R200, section 72 is a license renewal extension for mortgage originators, and that was requested by the Department of Commerce that there be so many new requirements are being imposed on them that it was thought to be wise to extend their renewal date. And then the repealers paragraph A there involves a couple of obsolete banking laws and a mortgage originator statute that is would now be inconsistent with things done in the rest of this bill. And then paragraph B involves repealing all of our current laws dealing with debt management services providers. So that's the Commerce article.
Super. Yes, Representative Osmond, it's not about trees, is it?
Madam Chair, and I apologize if I missed it, if I may have been out of the room at the time, but there's been some ads on the radio with regard to people being able to bring two lawsuits on with regard to automobile insurance. Is that in this bill, that what they're objecting to? Something to do with no fault? And
yes, counsel.
Madam Chair and Representative Osmond, that item is not in this bill. It says other automobile things, but not that one.
Makes life easier, doesn't it?
Good answer.
That's what I thought, too. Are there other questions from members? It's 7:45, and it's Friday night, and the sun is shining, and we know that we're going to have to meet again soon. So,
Madam Chair, the Senate will be scheduling the next meeting. We think it's very unlikely that we'll call a meeting tomorrow, but I can't 100% guarantee I won't. Okay, so I just, and Representative Wiginius and I will certainly work on the schedule together and cooperatively. We think we're very close to having targets, and so we don't know what our deadline is for our bill yet. So I would advise that we have, has everyone given their cell phone numbers, all the members, and probably staff need to make sure we have that on a list. But
we'll
also
get it Monday.
Madam Chair, Representative Osmond, if you don't mind missing anything, that's up to you. No, I don't expect that we'll have to meet over the weekend, but you never know what could happen, and everyone out in the public, interested parties, should obviously stay, look on the web for any notices, for any updates.
Ms. Heising, do you have a question?
Well, while she's talking, and Madam Chair, in the meantime, if we will, we'll announce our next meeting as soon as we know what it is, and we'll post it, and it'll probably be Monday, possibly first thing in the morning, but I really don't know yet.
I would think that's likely. Did someone have a question down? Did you have a question?
I just wanted to make sure the cell phone number list was getting around. Okay.
All right. Perfect. Okay. I want you to make sure you sign this before I adjourn. I'm ready to adjourn if people will agree to put their cell phone numbers on here before
Madam
they leave
Chair, we have everybody, all the senators and staff. We just need the House people to get the House.
Yeah. Okay. So we're okay here?
Yeah.
With that, thank you.
Do you have each other's numbers?
You all are going to be trading right now,
staff
aren't you?
Staff have each other's numbers. Okay.
With that, thanks everybody for doing such a good job tonight. Thank you.